Due to the graphic nature of this cult's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of the sexual assault of minors. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
Daniel Perez gasped as the car in front of him suddenly slammed on its brakes. Before he had time to react, four uniformed men piled out of the vehicle and headed straight for him. Perez had no idea who they were, but one thing was clear. This wasn't going to end well.
The men pounced, beating him until he could barely breathe. Then they left as quickly as they came, speeding off as Perez gasped for air on the ground.
He curled up in a fetal position, sure he was going to die then and there. And if it hadn't been for his friend Trish, he might have.
Like an angel sent from heaven, Trish saved Perez that day. She carefully helped him to her car, then sped back to their hometown for help. She refused to let Daniel Perez die, because to her, he was practically a god.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And this is Cults, a Spotify original from Parcast. Every Tuesday, we look at a cult's practices, their leader, and their followers. You can find all episodes of Cults and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
This week, we're taking a deep dive into Daniel Perez, later known as Lou Castro. Perez claimed that he was a seer, inhabited by angels who could bring dead people back to life. In this episode, we'll follow him as he travels across the country, recruiting followers and growing his reputation.
Next week, we'll learn how things at his commune eventually turned deadly. We'll dig into the life insurance schemes that brought in millions of dollars, and the detectives who spent years trying to bring him down.
We have all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry. I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't know much about Daniel Perez's childhood. The few facts we have read like a list of birth certificate details. He was born in November 1959 with black hair and brown eyes. He grew up in a small Texas town about 20 minutes outside of Corpus Christi.
And that's pretty much it. Little is known of Perez's earliest years.
Here's what we do know about Perez. As an adult, he joined the Navy as an airplane mechanic. After that, it seems he continued servicing airplanes as a civilian aviation mechanic.
But even at this point in his life, there are very few records, possibly because Perez lived under many different aliases. We don't know why he felt the need to constantly change his name, but history shows he has a tendency to lie a lot.
Vanessa is going to take over on the psychology here and throughout the episode. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but we have done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. A liberal use of aliases may indicate an involvement in criminal activities, according to a 2012 article in the Journal of Forensic and Legal Medicine. Within criminal justice, the primary reason to use an alias is to complicate law enforcement efforts to ascertain the identity of a person wanted for questioning. According to this paper, the use of aliases is indicative of broader psychopathology and considerable behavioral risk. Those who use aliases may also suffer from psychopathy or antisocial personality and engage in pathological lying, manipulation, and show a grandiose sense of self-worth.
But in the end, we can only guess why Perez used so many pseudonyms. During the mid-90s, his movements became clearer. Sort of.
At the time he was living in South Texas, somewhere in his mid-30s, he met a young woman named Patricia Gomez, or Trish as her friends knew her.
Trish was around 18 years old, give or take a year. She and Perez quickly embarked on a sexual relationship. And it's likely that during this period, Perez first shared some of his grand illusions with her.
Before we go any further, we should note that Perez's claims were pretty out there. He didn't usually provide a clear through line in his explanations, and he regularly contradicted himself. In short, his stories didn't always make much sense.
So let's start small, or at least smaller. Perez claimed he could make it rain on demand and heal the sick. He also said that he could predict the date that someone would die. But most importantly, he believed he was 1,000 years old and an angel. That was supposedly how he got his magic powers.
Although sometimes Perez changed his tune and said instead that his body was merely inhabited by angels, three of them. There was Arthur, the mean one, Daniel, the kinder one, and Amber, the angel of death.
It was certainly a compelling story, and it seems Trish was the first one to buy into Perez's claims.
But she wasn't the only one. By early 1996, Perez had met another woman named Marilyn.
Marilyn had a son and a 14-year-old daughter. The family was going through a time of transition, preparing to move to another city. So Perez graciously allowed them to move in with him for a few weeks.
But his generosity came with costs. He likely tried to convince Marilyn of his angel story to win her devotion, but that wasn't his only desire. He also targeted her daughter.
Not long after Marilyn and her kids moved in, Perez forced himself on her 14-year-old daughter. According to the girl's later testimony, he raped her multiple times.
When Marilyn learned what Perez had done, she became furious. She went straight to the authorities to press charges.
Perez pleaded guilty to the accusations. But when it came time for his sentencing, he didn't show up. He later claimed he was on his way to the courthouse when four uniformed men randomly attacked him.
If Perez is to be believed, they beat him within an inch of his life, then left him for dead. He would have died if it hadn't been for Trish. She took him back to Corpus Christi to find someone to treat his purported injuries. It's not clear if this meant a doctor or someone else.
But Perez says he sustained brain injuries from the purported attack. He said he couldn't remember anything, and he was terrified that the men might come back to finish the job. So he and Trish decided to disappear. They fled Texas and moved to North Dakota.
At least that's the explanation Perez later gave authorities. In reality, it seems more likely that he faked his own death. We're not sure how exactly, but when searching for Perez after he failed to show up in court, authorities found a badly beaten body in Mexico.
It matched Perez's size and age. And in the dead man's pocket, investigators discovered his wallet.
In retrospect, it seems as if someone deliberately placed the wallet to throw the police off Perez's trail. And if that's so, it worked.
The officers didn't suspect that they'd been duped. They thought Perez was dead and dismissed the case against him.
He became nothing more than a bad memory.
Except Perez wasn't really dead. He was off in a new state with Trish, ready to spread his gospel to more unsuspecting young women.
Coming up, another mysterious death. Listeners, most of you probably know that I host another podcast series called Serial Killers. What you may be surprised to learn is that we've been working on that podcast for 5 years now. So as a special treat for the fans, we've prepared an anniversary series examining the mythology surrounding four of the most feared killers who ever lived. Kemper, Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer. This four-part series uncovers the men behind the mayhem, analyzing what turned them into killers and how their lethal behavior made them renowned for all the wrong reasons. Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any true crime or storytelling fan, and this fifth anniversary special is not one to miss. Check it out today by following Serial Killers, free and only on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Sound the gifting panic alarm. You need to get an amazing gift. Wait, no, the perfect gift. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Now, back to the story.
In the summer of 1996, 37-year-old Daniel Perez fled from Texas authorities to North Dakota. His best friend, sometimes lover and devoted follower, 19-year-old Trish Gomez, went with him.
But Perez wasn't satisfied with just Trish. He craved more love and attention. In North Dakota, he quickly got involved with an underage girl, a 15-year-old who we'll call Callie. When she asked, he lied about being nearly 40, instead saying he was much younger, likely in a bid to get her to trust him.
According to later trial documents, the two began a, quote, romantic and sexual relationship. Clearly, Perez followed a pattern.
This time, he filled the young girl's head with all of his ludicrous claims. He told her he was a seer who could look into the future. He bragged about his ability to receive information from the other side and change the weather.
Callie ate up his lies at first, but after only 3 months in North Dakota, his time appeared to be up. One night while at Callie's home, authorities arrested Perez and rushed the predator into custody. It's unknown what tipped them off.
Here's where the story gets a little weirder. According to Perez, authorities arrested him, then deported him to Mexico. But he was a U.S. citizen, at least that's what he later testified, so he shouldn't have been deported.
But he did leave North Dakota, whether by choice or force. Sadly, that didn't mean Callie was free from his influence.
Perez was insidious. Over the next year, he kept in contact with Callie by phone. Even from afar, he continued to string her along.
At this point, it's not clear if Perez had some grand scheme in mind, or if he simply liked the attention he got from claiming to have mystical powers. Either way, he manipulated those around him.
And moving didn't slow him down one bit. In fact, he only got bolder. By 1997, Perez and Trish had moved back to Corpus Christi. There, Perez adopted a new identity, Lou Castro. Most who have heard of him know him by that name, but for clarity's sake, we'll continue to refer to him by his given name.
In Corpus Christi, Perez and Trish got a place together. By this point, the romantic part of their relationship seemed to have taken a back seat. Now they shared a platonic partnership.
It's possible that Perez kept Trish around for money. He certainly wasn't working for a living, but he must have known it was a precarious way to get by. He needed more than just the one follower.
One day, at his apartment complex, Perez met 34-year-old Mona Griffith and her kids, 9-year-old Lindsay and her older brother Cody. It was immediately obvious that Mona was a free spirit. She was spontaneous, loving, and accepting. She was also in the midst of a messy divorce and needed something new in her life. That made her the perfect mark for Perez.
According to social science writer Maria Konnikova, there's not a clear victim profile when it comes to those who fall for cons. Really, the best marker is circumstance. As she says, it's not who you are, but where you happen to be at this particular moment in your life. If you're going through a significant change where you're feeling vulnerable, isolated, or lonely, you're much more likely to fall for any con. For example, according to Konnikova, people in debt are more likely to fall for fraud that's completely unrelated to finances, like weight loss products.
Mona's divorce had led to financial struggles, as well as existential crises. Her life hadn't worked out the way she'd envisioned. Now she was searching for something that felt safe.
Perez recognized that and capitalized. As Konnikova says in her book, The Confidence Game, the con artist's genius lies in figuring out what precisely it is we want and how they can present themselves as the perfect vehicle for delivering on that desire.
At some point, Perez spoke about his mystical powers and how he could help ease Mona's struggles. And he made good on his word. Not about the powers, but he did bring Mona around to his place and introduced her to Trish. The two of them provided Mona with the support system she needed.
Perez even helped her with childcare, occasionally picking up her kids from school and sports practices.
It wasn't the first time Perez had tried to get close to a young girl. To get what he wanted, he played the long game.
When Mona finally divorced her husband, Perez did exactly as he'd done before. He opened his door and welcomed her along with her kids. At first, things were great. They became a sort of extended family: Perez, Trish, Mona, and her children.
For Mona, Perez was the safety net she desperately sought. He claimed to be an all-powerful being who could see into the future. She hoped he'd be able to tell them if anything bad was going to happen, and he promised to protect her.
Given everything she'd been through, Mona took comfort in Perez's stories.
Perez, however, still had secrets. If the authorities in Texas discovered he was alive, he knew he'd be arrested. He decided that he needed to move with Trish to stay ahead of the police.
When they told Mona about their plans to leave, she offered to go with them. She could no longer imagine herself without them. She saw this as another great opportunity to start a new chapter of her life.
After only a few months of living together in Corpus Christi, Perez, Trish, Mona, and her 10-year-old daughter, Lindsay, moved to Kansas. They formed the beginnings of a commune. Mona's son, Cody, decided to stay behind with his father.
In Kansas, Mona's devotion to Perez only grew stronger.
There, Perez also formed an affectionate bond with Lindsay.
One person who noticed was 17-year-old Callie, the girl Perez had groomed in North Dakota and continued to keep in touch with him.
She came to visit the commune for 2 weeks. While she was there, she got jealous of the way Perez treated Lindsay.
After her short visit, Callie went back to finish school. But before she could return for another visit, Perez up and moved everyone again. This time, they went to South Dakota.
If his small commune had thought of Perez as a mortal man, perhaps they would have questioned the decision. But they believed he was an angel and some kind of all-knowing being. So they followed him without question.
In South Dakota, the commune expanded. Mona and Trish both met partners and brought them into the fold. Mona started dating a 48-year-old pilot named Jim Chase and got engaged. Meanwhile, Trish met a mechanic named Brian Hughes, and the two of them got married.
Brian moved into the small, off-the-grid cabin along with the rest of the commune. We don't know a lot about his background, but it's clear he bought into Perez's story, just like the rest.
Perez's kindness and charisma shut out any doubts they may have harbored. He went out of his way to make each and every one of them feel special.
Thanks to his efforts, the commune now included 6 full-time members: Perez, Trish, Brian, Callie, Mona, and Lindsay. Mona's fiancé, Jim, we assume, still lived in his own place.
With more people to support, Perez felt the pressure to provide. It's not clear where his money was coming from before, but he needed a lot more of it, so he came up with a plan.
Together, Perez and Trish convinced Mona to take out a big life insurance policy. We don't know exactly what they said to her.
In the end, Mona took out a $750,000 policy. She named her daughter Lindsay as the beneficiary and Trish as her daughter's caregiver. That meant that if anything happened to both Mona and Lindsay, Trish would receive the payout. And sure enough, after Mona took out the policy, things took a turn for the worse.
In February 2001, Mona, her daughter Lindsay, and her fiancé Jim planned a trip to Nebraska for Lindsay's birthday. Jim was going to fly them there. It was the type of adventure Mona likely always wanted.
When the big weekend finally came, Mona, Lindsay, and Jim all boarded the plane together. Jim took his seat in the cockpit. As they took off, he noticed some storm clouds on the horizon, but shrugged them off. It was nothing to worry about. He'd flown through bad weather before. Then the plane lurched. Something went terribly wrong.
The aircraft never reached its destination. No one had any idea what had happened. Jim didn't file a flight path. so the three of them could have been anywhere.
When the news reached Perez, he sprung into action. He reached out to local law enforcement and asked to be kept informed about the search and rescue. After Mona's sister, Lisa, came to town, Perez did everything he could to keep her and the family in the loop. In a later interview with Dateline, Lisa said that at the time, she was grateful to have him there. He seemed totally in control of the situation.
What the family didn't know was that while Perez consoled them, behind their backs, he tried to cash in Mona's life insurance. But that proved tricky without a body. The insurance agency refused to pay out until they were sure Mona had passed.
Still, Perez visited the agency multiple times to try and get them to act faster. The agency refused to budge. It took the authorities 6 weeks to find the plane. There were no survivors.
The crash was a total mystery. The National Transportation Safety Board investigated the site. It didn't find any mechanical issues with the plane. They eventually deemed it a tragic accident, possibly caused by bad weather.
With the report in hand, the insurance company finally paid out the death benefit. A $750,000 check was made out to Trish, who then passed the money to Perez.
Sometime afterward, Mona's teenage son, Cody, came to visit. He didn't suspect anything beforehand. He just wanted to see his mom's old friend. But during their conversation, Perez got emotional. In between tears, he said Lindsay was never supposed to be on the plane.
Cody reacted with shock and confusion. He didn't know what that comment was supposed to mean.
Cody's mind reeled with suspicions after the comment about Lindsay. Perez was a skilled aviation mechanic. Could he have had something to do with the crash? He couldn't be sure. After all, no evidence linked Perez to the accident. But the mystery gnawed at Cody.
And it wouldn't be the last time one of Perez's followers died under strange circumstances.
Coming up, Perez recruits another family and establishes his Angel's Landing. Now back to the story.
In 2001, a member of Daniel Perez's commune, along with her daughter and fiancé, died in a mysterious plane crash. Afterward, the 42-year-old Perez collected a $750,000 life insurance payout.
With the money in hand, Perez and his two remaining followers, Trish and Brian, moved again. This time, they traveled from South Dakota to Lee's Summit, Missouri.
There, they were joined by Callie, the girl Perez first met in North Dakota. Now 20 years old, she came back to live with him. Around this time, Trish and Brian welcomed a baby girl into the world. The commune was now back up to 5 members.
Perez went about finding them a big enough house in Missouri. To do so, he enlisted the help of a local real estate agent named Jennifer Hudson.
Perez walked into their first meeting wearing a cowboy hat with his long hair flowing. He introduced himself as Lou Castro and implied that he'd made a lot of money trading stocks. He spent most of his time either at a cattle farm in South Dakota or his mansion in Texas. Now he wanted a country property for his extended family.
Jennifer found him to be extremely charismatic. She appeared thrilled to make his acquaintance. The two toured various properties around town before finding the perfect house. When they signed the paperwork, though, Perez put the house deed in Callie's name.
Apparently, Jennifer didn't think too much of it. She already seemed wrapped up in Perez's charm. They went out to lunch together often and quickly became friends.
Perez even introduced her to Trish and Brian, and they clearly left an impression.
In an episode about Angel's Landing by Deadly Cults, an excerpt of Jennifer's old journal is read aloud. At the time, Jennifer wrote that she found Perez and his friends' innocence and trust in people alarming, but she felt a strong connection with them and experienced a desire to protect them from the rest of the world.
Things were topsy-turvy. Jennifer thought Perez needed protection, but she was the one who was vulnerable. Perez played on Jennifer's emotions and made her feel important.
At some point early on, Jennifer likely mentioned her personal belief in angels. According to her daughters, she talked about saintly figures all the time. She believed they lived amongst people and protected those they chose.
Perez latched onto this. He eventually confessed to Jennifer that he was an angel himself. He'd claimed he died several times, and that the body he inhabited was just one of many he'd resided in. He also told Jennifer that he had the ability to see the future. He could tell a person when they were going to die so they could prepare. And that wasn't all. He also had the power to bring people back to life.
To most, the idea would sound ridiculous, but Perez spoke about death all the time. He made it so commonplace that it was normal inside the commune's shared living quarters. Those who spent enough time around him didn't even blink when he talked about the other side. He claimed the ultimate goal in life was to get over there. None of them realized that he was manipulating them. In a very real way, he pushed them to believe whatever he wanted them to. And it was all designed so he could take advantage of it later.
Unfortunately, that's exactly what happened with Jennifer. Like those before her, she fell under Perez's spell until he became a vital part of her life. He nurtured her dependence on him. Then, all of a sudden, he decided his commune had to move once again. To stay untraceable, he never stayed in any one place long.
Jennifer followed him and brought her two daughters along with her, a 10-year-old who we'll refer to as Brooke, and a 17-year-old named Sarah. The three moved with Perez and his group to Wichita, Kansas in 2001. There, they bought a 20-acre property that they called Angel's Landing.
They built three separate houses, one for each family. Perez got one, Trish and Brian got another, and Jennifer and her girls got the third. They made plans to build a swimming pool, dirt tracks for the ATVs, and stables for horses. They had quite a lavish lifestyle in mind for themselves.
All the while, Perez worked to make everyone feel like a big, happy family. They all ate meals together, and he threw parties every weekend. There were always drinks flowing and games happening. Perez himself was having a blast. He bought sports cars and radio-controlled planes to play with.
And the commune members were free to come and go as they pleased. There weren't strict rules dictating what they could and couldn't do. Jennifer was still a real estate agent. Brian still worked as a mechanic. All in all, life seemed good, at least for the adults.
But the two youngest members weren't so convinced about the new place. 10-year-old Brooke was a little skeptical of the things Perez told her, including the powers he claimed to have.
Her older sister, 17-year-old Sarah, agreed. Plus, she thought he was trying too hard to win her and Brooke over. But she did like Trish, who was the matriarch of the commune. Over time, she became like a second mother to the girls.
It was Trish who eventually persuaded Sarah and Brooke to believe in Perez's tall tales. She told them she'd personally witnessed Perez dying from a serious illness and then miraculously coming back to life.
When they heard that, the girls decided it must really be true. The two women they respected the most in life, their mom and Trish, both fully bought what Perez was selling. So the young girls fell in line, just like everyone else.
Once Perez got the girls under his spell, he pitted them against each other. He spoiled Brooke, the younger one, giving her whatever her heart desired. When she asked for a horse for her birthday, he got her three.
That kind of thing didn't sit well with Sarah, who grew jealous of all the attention Perez gave her little sister. Sometimes Trish stepped in to smooth things over and referee the sibling rivalry.
But it wasn't a game either of them really wanted to win. Not long after Jennifer and her daughters joined Perez's commune, his more sinister side came out. Both girls witnessed what they believed to be one of the angels inhabiting Perez, Arthur, the mean one. Whenever Perez was cruel or forced them into terrible situations, he always claimed an angel was doing the awful deeds. Perez swore he would never hurt either of them.
But that was never anything more than a lie. Perez was doing exactly what he'd done time and time again, grooming underage girls. Only this time, he escalated things. He decided to move 10-year-old Brooke into his own house.
Instead of staying with her mother and sister, she spent every night in Perez's bed. He convinced her it was absolutely necessary. This was Brooke's chance to take care of him. As a seer, he claimed he needed a pure young girl to have sex with him so that he could continue to live forever.
He cloaked his dark intentions with old biblical stories. For Brooke's part, she knew her mom and Trish had both vouched for Perez, and she'd grown to believe he loved her, and Brooke thought she loved him.
But she was just 10 years old, and Perez knew exactly what he was doing.
According to Brooke and Sarah, their mother had no idea what was going on behind closed doors. Everyone saw Perez as a sort of father figure. No one thought twice about him and the girls spending time together. He went out of his way to make sure his truly sinister acts were kept quiet.
Researchers Donnie Whitsett and Stephen A. Kent have found that cult leaders often create conditions where family ties are separated or minimized. The leader wants everyone to be loyal first and foremost to them, not to their family members. So they take steps to break down those bonds. They use language that makes them seem like a parental figure and try to fill those shoes themselves. Some even geographically separate children from parents to help solidify their dominance. As a result, according to their study, parents' authority over their children is undermined. The leader usurps the rights and obligations that usually adhere to parental roles. Parents become what amounts to middle management, as the group simply expect them to carry out the instructions of the leader, even though these edicts may go against their own parental instincts.
That's exactly what Perez did with Brooke, when he moved her out of her mother's house and into his own.
Perez had Jennifer completely under his thumb, so much so that she never even thought to question him. How could a regular person defy an angel? It was easier to just do as he ordered.
By the spring of 2002, 43-year-old Daniel Perez had 7 followers: Trish, Brian, their baby girl, Callie, Jennifer, and her daughters Sarah and Brooke. And despite the horrors happening under lock and key at Perez's home, they really thought an angel was watching over them.
What they didn't realize or were in denial about was that they really needed to be protected from him, because life was good in some ways, but only until the money ran out. And when it did, Perez would strike.
Thanks again for tuning in to Cults. We'll be back next Tuesday with part 2 of Daniel Perez's story. For more information on Daniel Perez, amongst the many sources we used, we found Dateline's Angels and Demons episode and Deadly Cults' Angels Landing, especially helpful to our research.
You can find all episodes of Cults and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
We'll see you next time.
Cults is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Carrie Murphy, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, and Aaron Larson. This episode of Cults was written by Alex Burns, edited by Robert Tyler Walker and Terrell Wells, with fact-checking by Claire Cronin and research by Brian Petrus and Chelsea Wood. Cults stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson.